Today we are visiting with Marta McDowell. Marta is the author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Marta lives, gardens, and writes in Chatham, New Jersey. She writes and lectures on gardening topics, teaches landscape, history, and horticulture at the New York Botanical Garden, where she studied landscape design. She also consults for public gardens and private clients. Her particular interest is in authors and their gardens, and the connection between the pen and the trowel. She's the author of All the President's Gardens, Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life, and Emily Dickinson's Garden. So some these books we're going to talk a little bit about as well, because there's just so many things that are just coming out of Marta's garden that we want to talk about. Marta, thank you so much for being with us here today.
It's my pleasure, Louis.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit about how did you get interested in gardening? Where, you know, because we all as kids like to play in the dirt, you know, we like to pretend we're planting something and all that stuff. But if you live out in, you know, somewhere where it's a farming community, where there's a lot of opportunity for gardening and for farming, then of course it's a little different. But tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, you know, I was a suburban kid, and I will tell you that my parents, while they both grew up in one on a farm and one in a dairy family in a rural community, they were not great gardeners. It was my grandfather and one of my great aunts who had these wonderful gardens. We'd visit them every summer out in central Illinois. So that's my little corner of the prairie. And those were the gardens that first imprinted on me. And I think that's why I grew up to be a gardener.
Now, what about, as you mentioned, the connection between the pen and the,
and the trowel.
Yes, ma'am. I just lost my vocabulary of gardening tools. Glad I didn't say something that was not even conductor drill or something like that. That's not good.
Well, you know, I was always a reader. Those are the two things that I really love to do. I love to read, and I love to garden. And it was sort of I don't know, one of these chance encounters. You know when you bump into something and it just something clicks in your head? So I happened to be driving across Western Massachusetts, and it was on a business trip, and I just happened to have a spare afternoon. I was close to Amherst. I had always read Emily Dickinson's poems and sort of understood some of them, but I always found her intriguing. So I went up to her home and discovered there that she gardened. And all of a sudden I thought, oh, and it was like a little portal opened and I could like explore her work through this little common interest that we shared. And it sort of all grew out of that.
Now, what you mentioned about Emily Dickinson, and one of the books that I mentioned at the beginning when I introduced you is Emily Dickinson's Garden. So that was one of the books that you have written. Tell us a little bit about that book. Did after that visit, did you decide to kind of put together a book about Emily Dickinson's garden?
Well, I was very early in the writing process, Louis. I'd done corporate writing, but I'd never done this kind of garden writing. But Emily Dickinson was really my first serious topic. And so it started first with an article and then, you know, my very first book proposal. And then it all went from there. So that book has been out of print for a while. And actually, I'm working on a revision of it for Timber Press, who's my current and beloved publisher.
And the other one that really caught my fancy, because I'm a lover of history, especially presidential history in World War II, Civil War. Abraham Lincoln is my favorite. But one of your books is All the President's Gardens.
So that's a funny one, because I had pitched to my editor the possibility of doing a book about that crowd of people in Concord, Massachusetts. They all wrote together, you know, people like Emerson and Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott and Hawthorne. They were all there, and they gardened together, too. And he said, in the nicest way, you know, I'd buy that, but I don't think anyone else would. So he said, you know, we haven't done a history of American gardening for a while, and would you be interested in doing that? Now, I kind of, I don't know, I'm sure my face fell. We were doing this on the phone because I thought, this is going to take me the rest of my life. And I don't know if I can, you know, like, can I make this interesting? And then I remembered that one of my students at the New York Botanical Garden had done a project on the White House grounds. And it was really interesting because it had changed so often since, you know, 1800 when it first started to be cultivated until now. And I thought, I think I could use that. So I asked the student if he would mind if I basically stole his project, which was a little short, you know, like 10-minute presentation. And he was very kind and said, you know, go for it. And so I pitched that to my editor to say, yes, I can show the history of American gardening, but through the lens of what happened at the White House, well, really starting in the 1600s, when it was basically cultivated by the native peoples and going on from there.
And as far as that book being out, is that still in print?
Oh, yes. So Beatrix Potter and All the President's Gardens, they're still very much available. And, you know, that was an interesting transition, particularly from the President's book. I went right into writing this book about Laura Ingalls Wilder, whose life, you know, extended for a long time. She was born in 1867, right? So I think, you know, just after the Civil War. And she lived till 1957. So it covered a lot of the same arc of American gardening, but from a very different perspective, you know, from a really working class agrarian perspective.
And so as you mentioned, this year would have been Laura Ingalls Wilder's 150th birthday. And it's hard to believe that, you know, that little girl that most of us can identify with, I guess, as far as what we think Laura Ingalls Wilder looked like in Little House on the Prairie, being 150 years old, we're going, wow, that's incredible. But this book, I love the way you open it up when you're she's sitting there and with Almanzo and they're working the farm and little Rose is there and she's saying, why is mommy working? Because this is Mansfield. And it just sets it up perfectly where you feel as the reader, like you're sitting there and you're also sweating and you're also, you know, that hard life that these people went through. But at the same time, you take us through the journey that she went through as she traveled with her family, with her husband. And interesting to say also that Almanzo never referred to her by her first name until after they were engaged.
Yes. Well, it was a very different time, right?
Yes.
So they were very proper. And then even after they were engaged and married, he did not actually call her Laura. He called her Bess or Bessie because he had a sister, Laura. And so he always had a, you know, a pet name for her, and she called him Manly.
I love the quotes that you have there from Little House in the Big Woods. The sap, you know, is the blood of the tree.
So I was really looking at this person's life and work from the point of view of places that she lived and the plants that surrounded her and that she grew and was familiar with, because I'm a garden writer. So I do a sort of, I'll call it garden and nature biography of Wilder, who lived in so many places and wrote about them with such, I don't know, tenderness and specificity that you could almost think of her as a nature writer. I mean, we don't. We think of her as a children's writer. But I think she would qualify if you think of her in a slightly different way.
And she loved, obviously, working in the garden, because when you open this book that you wrote, and it's called The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, where it says, Ma took charge of the day's work for the rest of them. And best of all, Laura liked the days when she said, I must work in the garden. So that was something that I'm sure Laura looked forward to.
Well, that's something that I certainly share with Laura. I would much rather be working out in the garden than doing anything inside the house.
Unless you live in El Paso, Texas, and you don't want to do that in the summer because it's so darn hot here.
Well, I will tell you, it can't, I'm sure, stand up next to El Paso temperatures and humidity. But we get some dog days in August as well that you would really just rather stay inside.
I understand. Well, we hardly ever have humidity. It's very dry heat. So I that's better than humidity, I'm sure.
Everything's relative.
We are visiting with Marta McDowell. She is the author of the book, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. This would have been Laura Ingalls Wilder's 150th birthday. And this book is not what you would think. Some of you might think, well, this is a kind of a biography and a snippets of her stories. It has that, but it has a lot more because it's actually about the frontier world, exploring the world in the late 1800s and early 1900s that Laura Ingalls Wilder lived with her family and then with her husband. So if you wouldn't mind going down the book and just kind of give us snippets of the book. And the first part, of course, is the prologue, but then a life on the land, and then the first chapter, clearing the land, the Wisconsin woods.
So Laura Ingalls Wilder was born in 1867 in a little place. I mean, really, it was just kind of a clearing in the forest, not far from the Mississippi River. So it's the west side of Wisconsin. And at the time, it was densely forested, which is why she called it Little House in the Big Woods. That part of Wisconsin, if you go today and visit and see the little replica cabin that was where her father had settled, it's really beautiful farmland, but the woods are gone. So she left us a lovely kind of story that is taking place in a part of America that's very different. And she talks about the big trees around them, the oak trees in front of the house. Each little girl has an oak tree. And she talks about, you know, playing on the stumps because, you know, her father, her uncle who lived next door, they were busily cutting down the forest so that they could plant a wheat crop. And Wisconsin was a big supplier of wheat in the years during and after the Civil War. So you get lots of plants, lots of wildflowers, lots of animals appear in the book. Her father was also quite the hunter. And they had a nice little life. But Charles Ingalls' pa had kind of itchy feet and decided pretty soon that they would move on from Wisconsin.
So the next chapter takes us on to New York.
Yes, so it takes a little zag, and it's sort of surprising if you're reading the books in order, because Laura Ingalls does not appear in this book, and it opens up and it's talking about a different family, the Wilder family, and a little boy with an unusual name, Al Manzo. And it's clear that the Wilders have more money than the Ingalls family. They have, you know, quite a going concern. James Wilder was considered a very industrious, sort of forward-looking farmer. And they had a nice house and, you know, kind of pretty things. And Mother Wilder grew geraniums and lilacs and just sort of ornamental plants in addition to, you know, spinning the flax and weaving the clothing and all that she did as well. So it's also got a lot about the native plants and places around this very, very far upstate New York. It's almost to the Canadian border.
And so now we're in Kansas.
That's right. So Pa packs up the family, the little family, Mary, the older girl, and Laura, the younger. Ma Ingalls is at that point pregnant. And they get in a covered wagon and they drive from Wisconsin all the way to Indian Territory. It wasn't a state yet. And, you know, they get there and Pa builds a new log cabin out on this very different landscape. And Laura calls it, you know, the place you couldn't see the end of, right? It's the prairie. So it must have been a real shock to this child who had grown up surrounded by woods to be out on this really open space. And so again, she describes it well enough that I could go back in time, really, and look at the geological history of the area and find out that Kansas once had a seacoast, and that is what left these little sort of, they call them cuestas out there, this kind of rolling feature in the landscape. So it's got a whole new set of wildflowers. It's got a lot of, you know, water and things like that.
We're visiting with Marta McDowell. She is the author of the book, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And what Marta is doing right now is she's kind of taking us chapter by chapter through the book. It's a wonderful book, great pictures, great maps, kind of quotations from the Laura Ingalls books. And there's just so much. And she's given us a brief overview of the book, because this is something perhaps that if you haven't finish your shopping, well, this might be something that you want to get. Anyway, Pa Ingalls really moves around. As we've seen, we've gone from Wisconsin, then with the Wilder family in New York, and then now we're in Kansas, and now Minnesota and Iowa.
Yeah, so the Ingalls family didn't really just make a beeline out west. They did sort of move around even a little more than the novels indicate. So they went back to Wisconsin for a bit. He still wasn't satisfied with that. So the family packs up again, and they go out to Plum Creek on the western side of Minnesota in a little town called Walnut Grove. And they settle actually first in a sod house, actually a sod dugout. So that was a surprise to me. I got to learn a lot about sod brick construction and things like that. But again, Charles Ingalls had great hopes because he said, you know, this is rich, level land with not a tree or a rock to contend with. Again, you know, imagine trying to hack stumps out of the soil. So here he is in Minnesota. It's got beautiful, beautiful soil. He starts a farm there. He has great hopes for it, but it was really not good timing because suddenly the Rocky Mountain locusts, or as she called them, the grasshoppers, ascended and really ate everything. It's hard to imagine, you know, hoping to make your living on farming and then have these swarms of insects just blacken the sky and come down and eat every plant, including the wild plants.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I read about that, I'm going, wow, this is, you know, kind of like, you know, biblical proportions here, what's happening, the grasshopper plague.
And it happened 2 years in a row. So, you know, you go, well, how did they live? Well, first of all, Pa basically walks to eastern Minnesota and is kind of a migrant worker, right? He works on other people's harvests where the grasshoppers hadn't come, goes back to Walnut Grove, plants again the following season. There was some government support, so they sent out seed wheat to farmers. The grasshoppers come again, and he just kind of gives up. And so they pack up and move on. And first they go to Burr Oak, Iowa, where he tries a bunch of different things. And, you know, they work at a hotel, he tries to run a mill, and he just can't get out of debt. They go back to Minnesota for a little bit and then decide they're going to move yet again, and this time out to the Dakota Territory. So they really do bounce around some.
And tell us about what happened in the Dakota Territory.
So Charles Ingalls gets a job first with some of the railroad camps. It's the period of the Great Dakota Rail Boom. So the railroad companies and the government are really pushing for settlement out into this new territory. You know, they want farmers out there. They want to create a market for the railroad moving along the way. They want to create stations where the trains can get water and they can get fuel. And so off they go. You know, he's all a part of that. And then they settle in one of these little railroad towns right from the beginning. It's called DeSmit. DeSmit, now South Dakota. And that's where they eventually settle. It seems that Pa wanted to keep on going to Oregon, but that maybe Caroline Ingalls just put her foot down and said, no, this is where we're going to stay. And so that is where the family grows up. They have two more daughters along the way. They did have a son who sadly died in infancy, but the four girls grow to adulthood in the Dakota Territory, and that is where the stories of Laura Ingalls and Almanza Wilder come together.
Tell us a little bit about the Little House on the Prairie television series, the books, and what you found through the research. I know that, you know, Hollywood can sometimes take creative license and, you know, there are a lot of things that are kind of taken out of proportion. But this was, like the books, Little House on the Prairie was very much loved by people who watched it, families, little girls, little boys, and of course, those books. It didn't matter whether you were a little girl or a little boy. They were just something that, you know, was adventure and you liked to read.
Yeah, they're really good stories. So the books came out in the 1930s and 40s, starting out in the middle of the Great Depression. And despite that, they were bestsellers. And, you know, they were eagerly awaited. Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote them when she was in her 60s. So she started late, but they were popular from the start. And, you know, they remained popular. And there was a producer by the name of Ed Friendly, whose daughter, they lived in New York City, his daughter, I think, was homesick, was the story, and she was reading a book, and it was Little House on the Prairie, and her father said, well, you know, haven't you read that before? And she said, this is the ninth time I've read it. And so he thought, well, you know, there must be something to this. So he took it to Hollywood. And, you know, he got together with Michael Landon and they created a television series that I'll say has the spirit of the Little House books. It has many of the same characters, some extras, additional characters. It's a lot about Mankato, which never appears in the books. And in fact, Little House on the Prairie, the book, is set in Kansas or Indian Territory, whereas Little House on the Prairie, the show, takes place all in Minnesota. So, you know, they go forth from the story. They take it as a starting place, let's put it that way. But it's still very much in the spirit. And as you say, a really popular show, started in the 1970s. And I don't think it's ever been completely off the air since then, including now.
And we hear so much about, you know, people who have recollections of reading books as children, and it's always Little House on the Prairie, the Boxcar Children, and Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys.
Yes, many of those were mine as well.
What does Marta like to read now?
Oh, I am a really, as I was as a child, a random if voracious reader. So let's see. On my bedside table at the moment, there is Big Rock Candy Mountain by Wallace Stegner, a book by Penelope Lively called My Life in the Garden, a book by John Fowles called The Tree, and a relatively new biographical novel about Zelda Fitzgerald called Z. As well as the new sort of authoritative biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder called Prairie Fires.
Ah, Prairie Fires just came out, correct?
Yes, it did. And I know the author, and I'm really looking forward to reading it.
The only one I've read is Z so far. But I'm like you, my bedside table has a little bit of everything. And my wife will say, how can you read all that different times, different? I say, well, you read a couple chapters and go to another, 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 another. And before you know it, you're finished.
That's right.
We're visiting with Marta McDowell. She is the author of the book, The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And this would have been Laura Ingalls Wilder's 150th birthday. You know, one of the pictures that you have a lot of interesting pictures in this book, but the one that's on page 292 that has a picture of Laura and Almanzo as they're sitting, waiting, for Old Settlers Day in 1939. And that's a great picture. And when people look at that, they're going, well, wait a minute, that doesn't look like the people from Little House on the Prairie I remember. And of course, it's much later.
That's right. But that's the time, that's what she looked like when she was writing these books. So, you know, I feel like, ooh, I just had my 60th birthday. And so I feel like I'm really like in the zone that she was when she was writing them. This picture also reminds me, Louis, that they loved their new technology. I mean, she always liked the simple things, but they enjoyed their car, and they would take these driving trips. And so this is a time when they drove from Mansfield, Missouri, where they actually spent the majority of their lives, back to DeSmet to see their family and friends that were left in 1939 and to participate in part of the celebrations. Because, again, they were among the very first families that homesteaded there. Both her family, Charles Ingalls, had a homestead, and Almanzo had his own homestead claims.
And back then, we hear a lot about, you know, people keeping diaries. And when I interviewed David McCullough, the historian, he said that it's sad that today a lot of the presidents don't really have diaries because, you know, they're afraid of, you know, the technology and what might get out, and you know, it can't be private like it used to be. But it seems like because of thanks to the writings of these people like Laura Ingalls, I'm sure that she wrote some pretty good diaries. Was that very helpful to you? And I guess it was when you did your research.
Yeah, she wasn't a regular diary keeper that we know of, except I will say that, you know, her daughter, after her mother's death, Almanzo died first in 1949, and Laura lived till 1957. And after her mother died, her daughter sorted her papers and kept some of them and didn't keep others. For example, there was a diary that Laura kept when she and Almanzo, with, you know, sort of baby Rose, were coming down from DeSmet down to Mansfield. That was the last move that they made. She kept a diary that her daughter later published as On the Way Home. And she did write letters. So when Laura once visited Rose out in California, and she sent letters back to Almanzo, and they were collected as well. And then there are a lot of other letters. And there is an interesting presidential connection, because Rose Wilder Lane left all her mother's papers, and as well as her own, to the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. So
wow.
That is where they are housed. Yeah. So you get to go visit West Branch, Iowa.
Marta, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today and to share from this lovely book, and also to share, you know, a piece of your life. We want to thank you for that. Is there a website or a Facebook page that people can go to find out more about your book and your books in general?
Absolutely. So they can just look on martamcdowell.com, and they can also find me on various social media under Marta McDowell.
And again, that's Marta with a T, MartaMcDowell. The book is The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Books. Again, Marta, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much.
The Book Club on Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Seth Van Meter. Our producer is Alex Dominguez. You've been tuned to The Book Club. I'm Louis Science.